So thanks for making me welcome, everybody. Lovely to be here with you. My name is David, as Gary's just said. And although I'm a vicar now, I used to be a pilot for British Airways. And I'm going to talk a little bit about flying and say something about why I left, which you might think is kind of a crazy thing to do. I suppose that's my first question, really, is why would you leave a cracking job? Imagine you had a cracking job. Maybe you're a Formula One driver. Anyone a Formula One driver here?
Yes.
In our minds, eh? Or maybe, you know, you're a Michelin star chef, or you've got the job of your dreams when you were a kid. You always wanted to be this thing. And imagine then getting that job and then leaving it. Why would you do something like that? And I mean, maybe illness might force you to leave a great job like that. Or maybe if someone came up to you with millions of pounds and said, you know, I'll give you millions of pounds to leave your job, maybe you'd do it then. Why would you leave a job like that? And really, that's what I had. I had that job, the job of my dreams. And I had, as a kid, always longed to be a pilot. And I worked with British Airways. That picture's me leaning out the window of a Boeing 737. Why would I leave that job? A job I loved. Being up in the air is amazing. Flying up through the clouds, nothing like it. The thrill of organising a diversion when the weather's rubbish and you've done a missed approach and that kind of thing. It's amazing. Why chuck in a job like that? Well, I'll tell you a bit about the job in a minute. But before I do, I just want to turn to a Bible verse because it's going to help us to understand my thinking. And this is from Matthew's Gospel. It's it's the shortest story that Jesus tells, I think. It's a very simple little parable to explain things. And Jesus said these words. He said, "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field." So it's really simple, isn't it? And it's the shortest little story you've got. My kids have got a children's storybook with pictures that manages to take about half an hour to tell the story. But Jesus does it in one line. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. So the idea is that there's something that's really valuable that he discovers, and in order to get that valuable thing, it's so important, so special, everything in his life he gets rid of, absolutely everything, to get that thing. That important and that brilliant. And of course, Jesus is talking about himself and what he brings, the kingdom of heaven. He's saying that to know him and to have him in your life is that important, that valuable, that actually everything else can just be shoved to one side for him. Well, what's that got to do with flying? As a kid, like I said, I love flying. And my dad was in the Air Force. He flew a desk, as they say. He was an electrical engineer, and I used to go to air shows. That's one of my early photos of a tornado at an air show, and I loved it. I've got early memories of an air show at RAF Alconbury, which is an American base, with the noisiest jets you've ever heard, and I was about this big. Utter amazing. So that's what I grew up with. And when I was a teenager, BBC had a programme called Fighter Pilot, and it followed the lives of some young men who were becoming tornado pilots from scratch, as it were. They've never repeated it. It's not available on video, so I don't know what happened. Maybe the RAF thought it was revealing too many secrets or something. But that was me. I wanted to be that, and I was just the right age. So if I could only be a fighter pilot, that'd be fantastic. So that was my goal. And I got into flying, first of all, through the Scouts. And here's me on my first ever flight in a small plane. With the this is the South Harrow Aviation. There's a scout group that actually had a glider. Brilliant. Actually, before that, I'd been on a Trident a few times to fly to Spain, where my grandparents lived. And one time, the captain let me sit in his seat and put on his earphones and hold the control column, and that was bliss. I don't know if you've ever done that. They don't let you do that anymore. That's great. So that was another very distinctive early memory. But anyway, as I went through my teenage years. These happened, glasses. So that was fighter pilot out. You can't have glasses and be a fighter pilot. So that was a real pain in the neck. Anyway, I thought I'll still get involved in flying. I'll keep going gliding. I went up to university and I ended up at university doing a maths degree. And two brilliant things happened to me at university. So one, I became a Christian. I'd grown up in a Christian family. But it's always been, I'd known about God, but he'd always been someone I had to prove myself to. And I was convinced that, you know, if I was good enough, then God would have me. And then I discovered through a church I went to, a friend took me to a church, I discovered actually I was never going to be good enough for God. The standard was too high, and in fact my life was nowhere near enough, good enough. And I knew that really. But actually Jesus had done everything. It comes back to that idea of treasure hidden in the field. And I suppose that was the moment I realised that Jesus was treasure. That I couldn't get myself good enough for God, but Jesus, by dying on the cross, done it all for me. And that was brilliant. And so I felt a great sense of freedom because of that. And I put my trust in Jesus and started to live for him. So that was one thing that happened to me. And the other thing was that I got a job, a place on a British Airways sponsored pilot training scheme. And a bit like becoming a Christian, two ways to be a pilot, and one is by paying for it yourself. And the other in those days, and paying for yourself was an arduous task in those days, you'd have to get your own licences done, but then you'd have to fly about, I think about 2,000 hours of private flying before you could get enough licence to go into an airline. And that would take you ages, it'd be painful. And also the airlines didn't like people who came that way because they had all sorts of bad habits. So that's one way, try and do it yourself. The other way was, at that time, for British Airways to pay for it all, absolutely everything. So a bit like me coming to Christ, I realised that actually Jesus paid for it all for me on the cross. But anyway, so same happened with BA, my third year. I've been gliding. So I've joined the University Gliding Club, and here's me about to do my first solo. So this means take up... Has anyone been gliding? No, I must do it. Get an experience. Right, this, you're attached by a rope to an aeroplane that's going to drag you up. When you put your finger out like this, he takes up the slack, so the rope goes taut, and I was off after this. And what you can't see in the photo is I'm wearing wellies. It's not the most glamorous thing to wear when you fly an aeroplane. Wellies because the grass was quite long on the airfield. But also they told me that if you ended up doing a long flight in the glider up and down this ridge that we were near, then you might need the wellies in order to go to the loo during the flight, take a wellie off, fill it up with well. Anyway, enough of that. So I got this post with British Airways, and I became a BA cadet when I finished my degree. I had about a week or two off, went straight to Oxford Airport, which is Kidlington, north of Oxford, and joined 14 other guys in our group. And we spent a year and a half learning to fly. So they take you from nothing. First of all, training on single engine propeller aircraft, like the Piper Warrior in that picture. I've still got the hat. What's my hat for? There you go. So you can put that on later if you like to. This one's a bit dusty and horrible, I'm afraid. They blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so single engine aircraft first, and then obviously all your commercial aircraft have got, all your big ones have got more than one engine. So then you learn to fly a twin, this Piper Seneca. The thing with a twin or more engines is that if you lose an engine, if one engine stops working, what happens to the aeroplane? Obviously, all the power's on one side, it veers like mad like that. And if you don't do anything about it, you crash. So part of the, I think, with twin training is learning how to use your feet on the rudders and how that all works to do. Emergency procedures. And then after about 18 months, I finished that course, have a licence. The commercial licence. And once you've got that with a twin rating and also instrument flying rating, so you can fly in cloud just using the instruments in front of you, you can fly approaches to airfields without actually seeing anything outside the aircraft. So you get your twin rating, your instrument flying rating. Once you've got that, you then need to learn to fly a specific airline type of aircraft. And in my case, that was going to be the 737 flying out of Heathrow. So there's a 737-200. And it takes about a ground course of somewhere between, in those days, it was about 8 to 12 weeks on the ground, and then simulators, and also, in those days, you actually had to fly a real aeroplane around a little airfield, doing circuits and bumps. Landing, immediately taking off, going back, landing, taking off, and so on. And so after, I suppose, just under 2 years from when I started, from just flying gliders, I ended up at the end of the runway at Heathrow, as a first officer, about to fly my first flight, and it was to Istanbul. And there I am, sitting in the flight deck of 737. A first officer is a co-pilot. In British Airways and most airlines, you operate on a seniority system. So if you can imagine the pilots in age or length of time with the airline, the bottom half are all first officers, the top half are all captains, more or less. Some people don't qualify to go from one to the other because you have to do tests, but more or less that's how it works. So when the guy at the top retires or dies, another person can become a captain, literally. And no matter how old you are, whatever experience, you go in at the bottom. What does the first officer do? Almost the same as the captain. And that's because it's twin crew and you operate on a shared flying basis. You can't fly an airliner on your own. It's just too much to do, whatever people tell you about it. And so while one of you handles the aircraft, the other takes care of pushing buttons, lifting levers and onto the radio and that kind of thing. And if you do, on short haul, two flights in a day, then one of you do one flight and the other do the other. So one of you will handle the aircraft for the takeoff and landing on one flight and the other will do that on the next one. So the captain, though, he has the responsibility. That's where the main difference and experience. So at the end of the day, when there's a decision to be made, a difficult one, or even the simple ones, it's down to him. And that's good when you're a first officer because you just haven't got the experience to do that and you're learning it as you go through. So the first part, the first officer, will share everything else. I'm going to answer some frequently asked questions so you can see a bit about airline flying. These are things that people have asked me. Can you fly different aeroplanes? And the answer is yes, but not at the same, well, almost not at the same time. To change between types takes a course. So I once flew the TriStar for a little while. They used to fly out of Gatwick at that time, and I was at Heathrow on the 737. They didn't have enough crews for their TriStars, and enough first officers. And remember I said about the seniority system? Who was the most junior pilot at Heathrow? So when they'd wanted a pilot for another fleet and no one wanted to go, who went? Me. So off I went down to Gatwick and I did my course for the TriStar. In fact, it took 2 months to do all the course of the TriStar. Huge aeroplane. We took one to, it was a little airfield somewhere in the Midlands, and we had this massive TriStar doing circuits and bumps. I don't know what the locals must have thought because it made a huge noise. Great fun. And then I flew on there for a month online. So I did loads of charter flights, went over to America a couple of times, and that was it. At the end of the charter season, they decided they had enough crews, so I could go back to the 737. So I went back and through. And the TriStar is an amazing aircraft to fly, but it was very old. And the 737 is much nicer to fly. So can you fly different planes? Yes. These days, they've built their aircraft cleverly so that you've heard of the new Dreamliner, the Boeing 787. That's got it's got a common type rating with the 777, the Boeing 777. So if people have been flying the 777, don't have to spend 2 months learning how to fly the Dreamliner. Just spend a couple of weeks, so if that, 8 days, I think, so. And Airbus have done the same with their new A350 and the A330. So you can fly different aeroplanes, yeah. Now, what routes do you fly? You tend to fly a fleet's route. So if you're on a Dreamliner these days, the Dreamliner will have a certain amount of routes it does in the network for the airliner, and that's what you'll fly to, and virtually nothing else. And for me, the 737 was European short haul, mostly not the big volume routes. So all these little places, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Gothenburg, Lyon, France, places like that. And on short haul, it was great fun because you'd do two or three sectors, so A to B in a day, and often you'd end up in some foreign city, spend the night there, maybe have some time off the next day or in the afternoon, and then fly back, do another couple of sectors. Place I visited a lot was Helsinki. Again, I was junior, so not everyone wanted to go to Helsinki, but I quite enjoyed it. And in Helsinki, you get in late in the evening, you have the whole of the next day off there, stay in a nice hotel. They give you money to spend, allowances, and eat wherever you like, spend the money, keep what's left. And then fly home on the third day. So it's quite enjoyable. Doesn't it fly itself? That's another question people ask. And yes, of course it does. You know, it's got autopilots, it's got computers, and you can program a route so that in theory you could do the takeoff, put the autopilots in at 500 feet, and it could do the rest of the route entirely, all the way down to landing. And you'd have to do a few settings along the way. but it could do it all its all, as it were. In practice, does that happen? No, because air traffic is varied. Obviously, you might have planned to go this way, and air traffic says, well, no, there's an aircraft coming from over there, there's another one coming over there. You've got to change the route, so you have to do that kind of modification. The landing, you don't always auto-land, so you often will fly the landing manually. And in our fleet, we were a very hands-on fleet, so we wouldn't put the autopilot in until we were 7,000 or 8,000 feet high. We'd take it out at about 10,000 feet. It was a great plane for manual flying, the 737. These days, the procedures have changed a lot, so people put the autopilot in quite early, take it out quite late, but it's still there, you can still manually fly it. And obviously, if anything happens, an abnormal situation, maybe you lose a generator or something, then you're there to fix that and put the right systems in place so that is taken care of. And one of the times when it does fly itself really well is for a landing when it's fogging. We've had a few days of that recently, haven't we, with aircraft at Heathrow. And they can actually, when it's weather like this, you can hardly see each other when taxiing, let alone the landing. And you come down through beautifully blue skies with a carpet of white. And when you enter the white, it's just completely white out. And you've got all the systems set up. And you won't see the runway until about 200 feet above the ground, or even less. 200 feet, what's that in metres? 60 metres, you know, it's a three or four storey building. You're really low. And then what you see is a vast bank of lights in front of you. We're at the end of the runway. And then the aircraft will land itself and you taxi off manually. It's great, it's very exciting. And that's a real twin crew operation. Two pilots working carefully together, monitoring instruments, everything set up properly. You want to know that when you come out at 200 feet, you're going to be in the right place. And so you're checking very hard. But it's quite exciting when it happens. Did I have any dangerous moments? 5 years of flying, a couple of failures, generator failure over the North Sea, not very exciting. We had a near miss over the North Sea where an air traffic controller had left another aircraft on a heading and forgotten to take him off that steer, and so he was going to hit us. But he had a traffic avoidance system which alerted him to that. And I saw him out the captain's window and I'm looking over, oh look, we heard someone come on the radio, and he said, I can't remember the flight number now, it was American 67, we're breaking left and descending to avoid traffic. I thought, well, that's very exciting, don't often hear that. I went like this, and there he was, breaking left and descending to avoid us. That was classified as low risk on that occasion by the authorities who looked into it. So that's about the most dangerous moment I had. These days, every airliner has that traffic avoidance system, and it works like it's a radar-based thing, so they can tell where all the other airlines are near them. It doesn't work for drones, though, so if you fly a drone near an airport, you need to be shot, because they seriously do a lot of damage. So why did I leave? Well, at the end of the day, it was down to the fact that, having found this treasure, Jesus, in my life, I wanted to be able to share that with more people, more. And obviously in the airline I could, and I could live for Christ in the airline. So two kind of things I adopted in my working life. One was to do everything for the Lord. There's a great verse that says, whatever you do, do it as if you're working for the Lord. So yeah, that was great. I could fly the aircraft as if I was flying for the Lord Jesus. And that was a great thing to do. So that's one thing I adopted. The other attitude I adopted was to, that was another verse, always be prepared, it says, to give an answer, a reason for the hope that you have.
It's our motto for the year, David.
Oh, right.
It's our courage motto.
Brilliant. Yeah, so that was the other principle I adopted, was that in my conversations with my fellow crew, I was always ready. It's lobbing the old thing about what I'd done at the weekend, that kind of thing, to see whether they'd bite. And often we'd chat in the bars down the line where you're staying in Lyon or Helsinki, we'd have a pizza together and chat. And so I would try and, talk to the captain or whoever about Christ, if I could. And obviously, I could still be doing that today, and that's a great thing to do, but I realised that I also had the opportunity to be able to do that with more people through working in the church, and so I made the decision. I had a bonding agreement, they called it, with BA. I had to fly for 5 years to pay off my training. At the end of that, I resigned and went and trained as a vicar. That's what I'm doing today. There's me in St Lawrence Church with my curate and the church family, and I've been doing that now for 20 odd years, And it's definitely the right thing to do. Do I miss flying? Yeah. I've got a great flight simulator. I just got that recently on my flip computer, so I still love doing the pretend flying. But you know, have I done what was best for me? And I think it's a great thing to do what I'm doing now. And I'm really glad I had the experience and the job I had. It was a dream come true for me, and it's been great to have that. But I think in terms of my personal being able to share Jesus with other people, that treasure, you know, it's definitely worth leaving the airline to be able to share that treasure that Jesus is with more people. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, thank you very much indeed. And you've given us a bit of an insight into what happens when we actually get on the plane. And I thought you were looking out the window, sitting on the plane going past somebody. Now, any questions? Anyone got any questions they'd like to ask David?
Yeah, just, was you married? Are you married?
Yeah.
Was you married through what you've just done, or what you've been through?
Yeah.
Because it's a great upheaval for your wife when you say, I'm going to work on the airlines.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I'm going to pack it up after flight.
That's right, yeah. And we used to, it was great, because I could get standby tickets for Claire, my wife. And so when, before we had kids, every weekend, she was a school teacher, if I had a flight on the weekend, we'd buy a standby ticket for her, and she'd come and fly, and she could, as long as the captain's wife wasn't around, get onto the jump seat. So she was guaranteed, jump seat is a little seat in the back of the cockpit, she was guaranteed a flight, and so she came with me to all sorts of places, it was great fun. But yeah, I mean, when I became a Christian at university, I was determined that I would somehow do a full-time job that was serving the Lord in some way. And initially I thought I could work for an organisation called Mission Aviation Fellowship, and they're a Christian airline, so they fly little Cessnas and things out in Africa. And that was that was my life's goal. And initially I thought, BA can get me my flying licence, I'll work for British Airways, and then when I've got enough hours and experience, I'll swap over. So when I married Claire, that's what she thought we were going to be doing. And she is... She's red-haired, fair skin, so the idea of working in Africa was a bit of a nightmare for her. And so here we are in Morden, in South London, so it's a bit more pleasant. Yeah, just a big pay cut there.
Yeah.
I worked it out once. I think there was something like, I've lost about 5 million quid or something, I think.
Matthew, what was your colleague's reaction when you told them why you were resigning, and was it what you expected?
It wasn't what I expected, because they were very sort of, what's the word? They weren't surprised in a way. There was very much, you've got one life to live, you've got to do what you've got to do, which is quite interesting. Except my boss, my line manager, who tried to keep me in the airline, he thought I was being mad. There were some people who thought I was being mad. He offered me, he said, oh, David, we can make you a chaplain to British Airways, and you can come and fly a management roster, which is about 25%, and then you can do all our weddings and funerals and things. I'd like the 25% on the aeroplane, but that wasn't my plan to do weddings and funerals with British Airways. So I said, no, it's all right. I think I'd better leave it all. And I think also, I had to leave it all. So I haven't done any real flying since. I had to, because otherwise, you know, the draw to bring back would be immense. So, yeah.
So you're not tempted to paraglide or anything like that?
I have wondered about paragliding and things like that. But here's a strange thing about me. I'm scared of heights, so I can't do heights where there's any kind of danger or imminent danger. So you see, in a glider or anything up from a glider, I feel really safe. The straps on a glider, you have a parachute, and they always say every time you add an engine, you never want to take an engine off again. So you go from a glider to mono to a single engine. You're never going to fly a glider again. Twin engine, they're going to fly a single engine again. Three engines, they're never going to fly two again. Because
then none.
That's why I've not done paragliding, I think. I can't stand on the top of a tower or something and just look over the edge. My whole body starts to go, woo! Not in an airplane, not in an airplane.
You just need a thermal.
During the time of your flight, did you experience any bad times, Jasper?
Sorry, sir.
Did you experience any bad times during your flight?
I mean, in two senses. Well, I mean, the bad times in terms of difficult things happening. I've mentioned one. There are others I could tell you about, but they're minor things. But in terms of flying, my wife always says to me, David, you've got to remember that you didn't always enjoy flying. And in the sense that flying I liked, but the people who worked with weren't always brilliant. But you'd get your roster for the month, and in those days, they came out on a printer. Whoa, yeah, you know, and then you get your roster, tablets and stuff. And a new thing came in after I've been working for a couple of years where they tell you the captains you're going to be working with in advance. And so they print your roster out, and on the bottom there'd be a list of captains. And what I would do, I'd get the printer, put my hands over like this, fold that over, rip it off and put it in the bin. Because I just didn't want to know who I was flying with, because there were two or three captains who were a nightmare. So, you know, like lots of jobs, there are days you turn up at work and it'd just be a pain in the leg.
I guess it's a very hierarchical system. And they would treat you like...
Some would, absolutely. Yeah, they had to do courses. When we joined, happened with BA was they'd run out of pilots. A whole lot of people joined in the 70s. And there was a place down at Southampton, I can't remember the name, but it was renowned for training pilots. And a whole lot of people from there joined in the 70s, and that's all they've needed for the last how many years. And then the airline industry started booming a bit, and they haven't got any pilots. So they recruited us in about 2 or 3 years, and took on about another 500 pilots or so. And these old guys didn't know how to fly the young guys. And they had all these incidents in history where the crew on the flight deck didn't work properly together because of hierarchy, because the captain was God. And whatever the captain said went, and you couldn't disagree with him. But that's the whole point. Why have you got two crews? So you can disagree with each other. So when he says flaps five, you say you're going too fast for flaps five, or whatever. Or when he sets this on his altitude, you say that's the wrong setting. And that's the whole point of your two crew, is to...
Did you ever feel suppressed from being able to say those things?
And some captains are still like that. They do courses, though, to help them to understand that these young people could actually fly aeroplanes. Yeah, and that was one of the issues. Some of them are just nasty people, you know.
That didn't make you want to climb the hierarchy, interestingly?
No, I would have done. I mean, had I stayed, I'd been quite happy being a captain. And some of the captains were brilliant. Most of them were great. Some of them brilliant. I did a flight to Munich once, and we had to divert because of really rubbish weather in Munich. It didn't start off going to Munich. We ended up in Munich. We were supposed to go into, I don't know, Stuttgart or somewhere, and we diverted. And we had the time of our life because we worked really well together as a team. He was a great guy, and we just meshed. We flew the airplane really well. It was a very successful operator. Good cabin crew. It all went really well, and that was, you know, that was great. And had I been a captain, that's the kind of captain I would be.
So, thank you very much indeed. I really, really appreciate it. Fascinating talk. So, thank you very much. And Paul's just going to tell us about our next.